Remember anybody ask you that? What are you going to do? I guess it depends on what they're asking, what the situation is, isn't it? It's very important. In our verse today, we read from Daniel 4, verse 2. Who's talking here in this verse? Anybody know? King Nebuchadnezzar. He'd gone through kind of a rough go-around from the time he ascended the throne until he said these words. He'd gone through quite a bit. He had even spent a little time chewing some grass for a while. But he had a testimony that he wanted to give. And so the verse, I thought it good to declare the signs and wonders that the Most High God has worked for me. That's a wonderful verse. We all should have some kind of testimony where we could be able to relate to that. In the Gospel of Luke, chapter 15, Jesus gave three parables. Y'all remember the three parables he gave? He gave one in 15, verse 1. It begins with the parable of the lost sheep. And in 15, verse 8, the parable of the lost coin. And in 15, verse 11, who is in 15, verse 11? The prodigal son, yes. The parable of the lost sheep is about someone who knows that they're lost and wants to be found. The coin is someone who is lost and don't know they're lost and doesn't know they need to be found. Obviously, a coin obviously doesn't have that kind of mentality, but it's a parable to reflect that. And then the lost son represents one who is lost, someone who is lost and knows that they are lost, but yet does not want to be found. Three groups of people in different states of lostness, three different groups. I'm going to talk to you today about a son who was lost, a son who knew that he was lost. He had no doubt. He knew that he was lost, didn't care that he was lost, and didn't want to be found. That son was me. For a significant portion of my adult life, I was that son. I knew what was right. Absolutely knew what was right. I knew what truth was, and yet I didn't care. A most dangerous place where one can find themselves. You know what is truth. People come up to you and try to say, well, you know, the Bible says this, the Bible says that. Yeah, I know. I know all that. I agree with you. It's right. What are you going to do? I'm not going to do nothing, so I don't care. I don't want to hear what you have to say. I already know it. When I'm ready to do something, I'll take care of it. Otherwise, leave me alone. I knew I was lost and wanted to stay there. Unteachable and unreachable. Knowing the truth, firmly believing it. I wouldn't work on the Sabbath. You wouldn't put a piece of pork in my mouth if I was starving to death. But yet it didn't make any difference because I was still going to do what I wanted to do. I rejected the truth. You see, I was born and raised a Seventh-day Adventist, third-generation Adventist. My grandfather, the gentleman you see up there in the left-hand corner, seal holder, he was a seeker for the truth, and he was the first one in our family to learn of the Advent message. He was an honest man. I mean, he, like Abe Lincoln, he was as honest as they come. Believe strongly in God, but because of ignorance of health reform, he was a drinker and a smoker. He didn't know any different, but he prayed for knowledge. He wanted to learn more, and he longed for truth. One day he was at his in-law's house, and my great-grandmother got a flyer in the mail for an evangelistic series that specifically had something about the mark of the beast, and she wanted to go see it, but she couldn't drive. And so she asked my grandfather, will you take me to this meeting? He said, sure. You know, he wouldn't hear about the mark of the beast. And so he took her. And so they went to a tent meeting similar to this right here. This isn't the actual meeting, but this was similar to the meeting they had in Moreland Park in Owensboro, Kentucky, a place where I grew up and was raised. My grandfather attended those meetings faithfully, and he was convinced of the truth immediately upon hearing this message. There was no question about it. And when he left the meetings, when they were over, he stopped smoking and he stopped drinking. And he never had the desire for any of those two again as long as he lived. Never. I mean, that's a blessing. That didn't happen to most people. The Lord just totally took that from him. He didn't do it. And he was soon baptized after that. His life and his descendants' life were forever changed by a simple little flyer that came in the mail. My mother learned and retained all those beliefs as she was growing up. All throughout my early life, I was taught these things. I was taught the beliefs of the church, the Seventh-day Adventists. I was taught about the writings of Ellen White. I was told things she said and probably a few things she didn't say. But we were firm believers in the Advent message and the prophetic ministry of Ellen White. We were regular church-going Adventists. We went every Sabbath. We practiced good habits. We didn't eat unclean foods. We weren't vegan. We ate the biblically clean meats. We abstained from most of the worldly customs. We had our TV and a few things we didn't want to give up. But in general, we gave up the things of the world. We were your typical Adventists. We were nominal Adventists, but we were still Adventists nonetheless. The foundations of my life were firmly laid in that early time of my life. I grew up hearing the truth. But sadly, with all that knowledge and with the family history, I embarked upon a life that took me a long way around to finding Jesus. Instead of going from point A to point B, like many of us, I went A, Z, J, K, U, back around, zigzag every which way, not knowing where I was going, not knowing where the end was going to be. And this started when I was sent off to academy. Turn, if you will, with me to Luke chapter 15. We'll be standing in Luke 15, and we'll start with verse 13. And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together and took his journey into the far country. August of 1976. What a horrible time in my life. At that time it was. 14 years old. Julie, you remember that picture? 14 years old. Hadn't sheltered mama's boy. Didn't want to leave home. Stayed there. You can get me away more than a day or two. Wouldn't go away. No sense of responsibility. And then at age 14, I was sent off to Highland Academy, 120 miles away from where I live. Everybody know Highland Academy here? A little bit north of Nashville. I remember watching them drive off or drop me off. Have you heard of somebody taking a, I don't like using this analogy, but taking an animal that they don't want, and they put them in the car, drive about 30, 40 miles out in the country, and drop them off, and zoom. Well, I was at that animal out there watching them go zoom. Big crybaby, wanting to go home. Didn't want to be there. I knew that I was going to be there. All my life I'd been told, when you go to high school, you're going to Highland Academy. Your aunt, your uncle went there, all these people went there, you're going to go there. I knew it, but knowing it here, and then when you're actually there being dropped off and feeling abandoned, it's a whole different story. But my parents had good intentions. They wanted me to get a good Christian education. They suffered through having to pay those, they were high bills at the time, $325 a month. Compared to today, what we paid for a year, it's about a month here now. But they sacrificed for me. I knew they had the best intentions. The problem was I wasn't ready. Some kids are. I wasn't. And within a year, I was making changes in my life that would follow me for a long time. I went from listening to top 40 radio to hard rock. I went from Casey and the Sunshine Band to Black Sabbath. That was my turnaround in one semester. From drinking Dr. Pepper to drinking hard liquor. This was in academy. From being a good kid to being an infidel. From praying to Jesus to mocking Jesus. That was what happened to me in 1 year. And he took his journey into a far country and there wasted his substance with riotous living. Especially that last part, wasted his substance with riotous living. I didn't have much substance, but I wasted my life with riotous living. Academy was tough. I found my share of troubles there. I've met some wonderful people there. I got some many blessings there. Following my journey at Highland, I made a trek to Southern Missionary College. Anybody remember SMC? Anybody old enough to remember SMC? It wasn't because I wanted a Christian education, but because my best friend, you remember David Piper? David was going to school there, and he asked me to come to school there, and so I did. Probably not the best reason for attending a school because your friend, but it was a Christian school nonetheless, and I was there getting something there. Tim's father was an instructor there when I was there. I took a class from him. But one semester and $3,000 later, that's how much one semester at Southern cost back then. That's about what one class cost today. Back in 1980, that's what you could get at Southern, a whole semester for that. I left. I left to go out on my own again. But it wasn't all for not being there. When I came back to Southern, 4 years ago, some of the classes that I took there actually still transferred into my degree, so I didn't have to take some of the classes I would have. So, that $3,000 did pay off a little bit. It saved me some money. When I left Southern, I didn't want to quit school, and so I went to college at Western Kentucky University in Bowling Green, Kentucky. I thought I'd have a shot at some degree. I've been taking computer programming and bookkeeping as a double major at Southern, and so I thought, well, I'll just keep my computer going at Western. They have a great computer program there. But again, that lure of having a good time, the fun that the world has to offer, the abuse of mind-altering substances got in the way. And all during this time, during this haze of scholastic Laodicea, I get a call from my mother. She informed me that after 30 years of marriage, she and my father were getting a divorce. The only real stability that I had in my life, up in smoke. And so did any direction I had left in my life. So after 1 year at Western, I was back home, or at least what was left of home. And so I stand with my dad, and I begin working as an orderly at the local hospital there, making decent money, for being a bedpan jockey. It wasn't bad money. It was pretty good. And I went out on my own. And, of course, the partying, broken relationships, dollar after dollar going down the drain, year after year. This pattern continued. It just kept going over and over. And finally, in the 90s, I said, that's enough. That's enough. I'm going to move away to start over fresh. Guess what? How much do you think changed? The only thing changed was the location. And that I found myself married with a stepson and a biological son 2 years later. And I did manage to get a one-year machinist degree. And if you know me, I'm not the most mechanically apt person. That was not the degree I should have been pursuing. But I got one nonetheless. And the marriage, it was a disaster. And after the second year of marriage, my biological son TJ was born, and my wife Angie began to exhibit some really strange behaviors. They began shortly after we moved back on some property where she grew up. We had a house there, we relocated there, and started acting weird. She started having problems. She began drinking heavily and abusing medication. It was during this time she told me that she had been abused by her father on this very property, and these memories were coming back to her. She couldn't deal with it, and she never could medicate it enough. And all I can say is the hell that ensued the next 3 years, for those 3 years, can't be verbalized. If you ever picture what hell is in your mind, that was what hell was at that time. But in February of 1999, that all came to an end. Angie was a nurse, and she was working in a local nursing home, and she had access to medications. In this case, it was insulin, except she was not diabetic. If you take too much insulin, which she did, she had unsuccessfully in her past attempted to take her life from a teenager. I found later on that she had tried it before, but this time was different. She succeeded. A massive overdose of insulin brought her life to an end. Two major strokes, blood sugar down to 2, didn't know for a couple of days what it was, so we found the needle in the house. It brought her life to an end, but it also brought my life of running from God to an end. We'll continue reading in Luke 15, verse 17. And when he came to himself, he said, "How many hired servants of my father's have bread enough and to spare? And I perish with hunger. I will arise and go to my father and will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee, and am no more worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thy hired servants." But when he was yet a great way off, his father saw him and had compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. When I was so far away running from God, he was still sitting there patiently waiting for me. And when I came back, he came running to meet me. It's amazing what God can do for you when you allow him into your life. In a short time after Angie's death, I began to go back and to pray and to study the Bible. And I began reading much of Spirit of Prophecy. Every time the church was open, I don't care if it was to mop the floors, I was there. I was there constantly. I was involved in every meeting that took place. I just totally immersed myself in spiritual things. I was thinking, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before thee, and I am no more worthy to be called thy son. Make me as one of thy hired servants. Let me do for you whatever I can." But you know, he had greater things in store for me than mopping floors. Things beyond anything I could have ever imagined. I should have had an idea when I began to help in an evangelistic series held by a good friend of mine, John Earnhardt. Anybody know John? John Earnhardt, he was an amazing facts evangelist, pastor in the Carolina Conference, cousin of former race car driver Dale Earnhardt. You may see the resemblance. They look quite a bit alike. Well, prior to the meetings, I purchased a Bible. It was called the Modern King James Version. It was a version I'd never heard of, but when I read some of the samples they had, I thought, wow, this is really good, and I ordered it. And it was probably the best translation that I have ever read. I loved that translation. Until I got to the Gospels. And when an evangelical publisher starts inserting some of their own ideas into the words, it becomes a problem. They changed where it said, like the women went to see Jesus on the first day of the week. He changed it to the first of the Sabbaths, or the first of the new Sabbaths. He was doing a doctrinal change by using some obscure Greek translation he found somewhere, heaven only knows where. And in that Bible, as I was looking through it, in the foreword, he quoted Revelation 22:19. "If anyone takes away from the words of the book of this prophecy, God will take away his share of the tree of life and the holy city which are written in this book." So I went home, got on my computer, and wrote Mr. J. Green, the publisher of this Bible, a little letter reminding him that he had changed the words and he was condemning himself with the words that he was saying that people shouldn't be doing. He didn't like that too well. He tried to explain it away, but it was. And so I showed John the letter. And he looked at it, he said, "Wow, that's pretty impressive." He said, "I couldn't have done that. He said, "You need to think about going into ministry and some sort of lay ministry type work." Boom, a seed was planted. He planted it right there. And I thought about it for about 5 minutes. The seed was there, but the ground wasn't ready. It lay dormant, that seed, for many years. But eventually that would change. During the ensuing years after this, being a single man with two kids, God saw that it was not good for man to be alone. Apparently he knew more than I did. After my poor track record, I was ready to hang up on ever being in a relationship again. I said, "Never, ever, 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 ever will I get married again." 16 and a half years later, it's sad to say she's not here. She's in Washington State right now with Matthew at Young Disciple Camp. But the best thing that ever came in my life showed up from something I said would never, ever happen. Aren't you glad God knows more than we do? Somewhere in the year around 2013, things began to take a change. Finally in the right direction. I was going towards Z this time after going all the change of alphabets everywhere. And we'd been going to church and, you know, doing things. We were still kind of lukewarm in our relationship. And so things began to make a turn. Shan started, I got to say, the credit goes to God impressing my wife to make changes that I was not willing to do myself. I was content to sit in front of the TV watching Adult Swim, watch Ice Road Truckers for hours on end, Swamp People. Yeah, very, very stimulating intellectual stuff. And I remember one night we were sitting there. We'd always watch a certain show. And one night, you know, she had been wanting to get back into church more and doing, get more involved. So she said to me one night, you know, this is our time together. You know, this is husband and wife time watching stupid shows. She said, you know, you go ahead and watch it. I'm going to go study my Sabbath school lesson. I got mad. Imagine that. She wants to study her Sabbath school lesson. I get mad. And she continued to do that because she had been praying, Lord, how can I change my husband? God said, you can't change him. You're going to change yourself. Let your witness be an example. And eventually that worked. So I said, whatever. Click. TV off. We started studying. Started going to prayer meeting. Got rid of the cable. That was my crack, by the way. You get rid of cable, that was something. But not only after doing that, I found I had much more time. I found that I had money left in my pocket. I wasn't wasting on that stuff. So we started going to prayer meeting. It was a blessing. And it was during prayer meeting that 14-year-old dormant seed that had been planted by John Earnhardt began to spring to life. There was a man by the name of Keith Dowell. I wish I had his picture. I couldn't find one. I couldn't get in touch with his daughter. A man who made a tremendous impact on my life. I was living in Asheville, North Carolina, on the campus of Mount Pisgah Academy. Keith's daughter was the girls' dean there, and he came there to stay with his daughter, but he had been diagnosed with some sort of rare cancer, and he was coming for treatment. And so Keith started attending our prayer meeting. And I remember Keith, he used to talk a lot, and I thought, man, does this guy ever stop talking? But he was saying things that were actually good things. And so one night, and Keith, you know, he had to, on Mount Pisgah Academy, he lived up in the apartment, the girls' dorm, there's a big hill you had to walk up, and Keith had a cane. He would have difficulty. And so after prayer meeting one night, I asked him, I said, you know, can we give you a ride up there? And so he did. And so we went up to his house and started talking to him. And he started sharing with me these Bible studies he'd been doing, things about his life, and we developed a friendship. Well, he always would give me things to read. Things after things, I just didn't have time. So he'd give them to me, I'd take them home, and just put it on the shelf. And he just kept giving me books. One day he gave me a book. It's a shame, you know, it takes somebody's death to get you to do something. But it took his death for me to get him to read a book. One day, you know, when I get to heaven, I see Keith. I'm going to have to laugh with him, tell him, you know, you drove me crazy with all those books, but thank the Lord you did that, because I'm probably here because of what you did that night. It changed my life. And it wasn't the Bible. It wasn't anything Spirit of Prophecy, Ellen White. Those books were wonderful books that had a profound influence on my life. But this book was a book that was dealing on church governance and history, a thing that happened in our church back in the 50s. Things that, you know, unless you're an Adventist and, you know, and have an understanding, it probably wouldn't be a whole mean a whole lot to you, but to me, it was something that affected me. It's called a book entitled A Fork in the Road by Herbert Douglas. It dealt with issues that as a church, certain theologies they had that changed at a certain point of time that were now being taught differently. When I grew up, I was taught things a certain way. I'm not going to all the theologies, I'm not going to go into that. But when I read this book, I was reading things that I'd always believed, but then I had been taught later were not correct, incorrect theologies. And so as I read this, I thought, wow, you know, it hit me. And so it drove me to study harder. It made me go dig for what I believed, not because of what somebody else said, but because of what the Word of God said. And Herbert Douglas put it in such a way, and I'm such a godly man. And I'll tell you, I wish I would have brought the real book. I wanted to bring it with me, but it's in a box with a bunch of other books right now. I couldn't find it. But I cherish that book. It's something important. When he died and I read that book, and I went back to his daughter, Becky, and I was going to, you know, give her his things back. And I told her the story. She said, I want you to have that book because it would mean something to my father. And that it been a blessing to me, that one book. And so it just drove me back to doing what I knew God wanted me to do. And so for about a year or so, Shannon and I were praying and studying, saying, God, what do you want us to do? Find something for us to do. Have anybody ever prayed that prayer? Does he ever find you something to do? If you haven't prayed that, try it sometime. God does not think like we do. See, I was thinking of maybe, you know, well, God, you know, maybe a Bible study, you know, find somebody to witness to. Ooh, maybe even, you know, be a head deacon or elder, you know, high, lofty goals. But God doesn't think on this limited scale like we do. And he proceeded to turn our world upside down. Be careful, very careful what you ask for, because you will get it. It was during this time I started looking at small, seemingly insignificant things in my life. And when I did this, I saw things in my life where God had been directing me. It's amazing how, you know, you'd be walking this way and God can put them in to turn you this way. You know, you might be zigzagging and zigzagging, but you're going a certain way, kind of like a cattle through a gate. You know, you have no way to go one way because there's no gates out either way and there's something pushing you from the back. If you try to go against it, you're going to get run over. And I was seriously struggling with the direction God wanted me to take in my spiritual life. I didn't really know. Have you ever said, well, God, I want you to do something for me. I want to do something, but I don't know what to do. Will you send Gabriel down and say, okay, I want you to do this? He doesn't work that way. But he gives us little hints. And we have to be looking for these little hints that he gives us. And he was directing my life with some little hints. One of them, Shan, I remember as I had gone back and reading this book and other things, I got really immersed in that year. So my knowledge really grew. All the stuff that I'd forgotten over the years had started coming back. And so Shan and some friends of ours had asked me, you know, Tony, have you ever thought about going into ministry? Not. No way. That was not something first of all, I hated being in front of people. Couldn't stand it. It's amazing, you know. I like it now. But back then, you know, I remember when I was in theology, you know, and we had to do our first sermon in front of the theology students. You know, you go up there and they say, okay, I want you to do an 8-minute sermon. 8 minutes? What can I preach about for 8 minutes? And of course, when we're sitting there in class, everybody's sitting there with a piece of paper. Hands in pocket, homiletical ideas, all these things they were checking you off on. And you're sitting there trying to preach, you see people writing all these things down. And I thought, hey, man, how am I going to do that? And I had 2 sermons in a semester. And I thought, man, this is killing me. Until I got it, had to do it every week. But I didn't want to do it. I just said, I can't do that. Well, it wasn't long after that we were out shopping. We went out to a Ross department store in Asheville. And I was there, and a pastor friend of mine, Pastor Mark Swearingen, he's a pastor now up in Knoxville, but he was a pastor down there. And he asked me a question. As we were talking, we've been talking about things within the church, things going on. And he just out of the blue said, "Tony, have you ever preached?" "Well, no, Mark, I haven't." And then he asked me a question. "How would you like to preach at one of my churches?" So I got a little small church, a great jumping off point. You know, the people there, they won't say anything. They won't bother you afterwards. It could be a good place to start. And I remember thinking in my mind, "Oh, man, how can I tell him no? Let me pray about it." Yeah, he couldn't argue with that one. He knew what I was doing. I was thinking in my mind, there's no way. But as we're walking out of the store, there's this irritating thing behind me poking me in the back, saying, "See, I told you so. Sham was telling me, I told you need to go into ministry." She said, "Don't shut your mind to God's leading." Don't you hate it when your wife's right? Well, maybe the wife's like it. She'd been constantly telling me about ministry. She wanted me to go into ministry. She obviously knew more about what God wanted for me than what I wanted for myself. Then the next thing happened. There was a man going around. He's a guy who does a lot of seminars, very popular in some arenas. But things he was preaching were scripturally wrong. And he was coming to our church. And I didn't want him coming to our church. And I had to have a reason why he shouldn't be coming to our church besides just my opinion. And so I contacted the Biblical Research Institute about what they had regarding this gentleman. Gerhard Fondel, the man who's head of Biblical Research Institute, a few weeks later, sent me a letter back that started out, "Dear Pastor Kimbley." I like that. That had a good ring to it. I like that. And so some of the pieces kind of started saying, well, you know, I started, after a few knocks in the head, you know, some of it started kind of seeping through. And then in mid-June of 2014, some of the final pieces of the puzzle came together. Job advancement opportunities where I was working was not coming through. I was working a job where I knew the job better than everybody I worked with. Advancement for opportunity came, but I would never get the raises. I trained a guy, and the guy was, I'll be kind, he should have been doing the work. But he ended up getting that promotion. I thought, what in the world is going on? And it was getting quite irritating. And I started thinking, well, maybe this isn't what God's wanted me to do. And at the same time, Matthew was scheduled to go to the At First Music Festival at Southern. It was a violin camp where they sit there and play music together and do various things, so he was scheduled to go. During that time, I was still working for the school system, and I was an 11-month employee. The last months of June were the last 2 weeks of the work year. We were doing inventory and all these things. You cannot go. You cannot get off. So Matthew was going to go, and Sham was going to go. And it's an amazing story what happened. I can't go into all the details, but Sham, during this time, was asking me to go down there to the camp. She didn't want to drive by herself. I told her, I can't get off work. I can't do it. She said, ask your boss. I'm telling you, she won't let me off. She's meaner than a snake. She won't do it. Ask your boss. Whatever. So I called her. She said, well, you got the time built up. Take it off. Oh, I hated to admit she was right. But she's right, you know, quite often. See, she's not here, I can say that now. The Lord had been silently prodding me towards ministry. And he was closing doors at the time. Like I said, like that cattle being led through a gate. You know, you just feel like you're being railroaded to. But God doesn't railroad unwilling souls. Well, at work one day, something happened that broke the camel's back. I said, that's it. I'm done. I'm finished. I'm going to quit. And so I called Shan. I knew I couldn't run anymore. I told, you know, I knew what God wanted me to do. I knew I was going to look towards ministry. I said, okay, God, you know, I know the Jonah story, you know, and there's Nineveh and there's a whale. You know, and right now I'm kind of leaning towards that whale's mouth. And, you know, either way out of the whale is not what I was looking for. And so I said, okay, Lord, you know, send me where you'll have me. So I called Shan and said, Shan, I've made a decision. And I said, I'm quitting my job. First words I hear from her mouth are, quote, what are you going to do, preach? I said, well, yeah. All of a sudden, man, I hear this yelling, screaming, laughing, and giddy, and I mean, she was as happy as I've ever heard her in my life. She was happier than I was. Here I was telling my wife I was quitting my job, and sure, she's sitting there doing backflips. I was kind of taken back, and so I went back in after hanging up. This was during my lunch break. I went back in with my fellow coworkers, and, you know, they knew how I was spiritually, and so I talked to a girl's name was Terry, and I said, Terry, I said, you know, at the end of this, when we're done here, I said, I'm going to quit here. And she looked at me, and she said, what are you going to do, be a preacher? How many times does God have to hit you in the head to realize what he's wanting you to do? I said, well, cool, but now what, you know? And I'm sitting there working at a hourly job, don't have any money in savings, need to go to Southern Adventist University, which is going to cost $25,000 a year, which I don't have in my spare, my pocket change. I don't have a place to live. But Matthew was going. We're going down to Southern. I said, well, you know, while we're down here, we might as well just look around and see, you know, what the options are. So Matthew was. We got down here, and he went to his lesson one day. And we said, let's go. In this interim, I'd sent him my application to Southern, my $200 fee for whatever that went for. They make you pay. And I had my transcripts all sent from the 500 colleges I'd been to and all these things that they needed. I had it all sent in. And so we came down to Southern. So when Matthew's playing, we walked over to Wright Hall, the administration building. This is where we really see God's hand at work. This was in the middle of June. Summer semester, skeleton staff, very few people there. And here we go, seeing what's doing. Maybe see what's going to happen in a year or two if we can work something out. Went up to the administration building, went to financial aid. In about 20 minutes, all the financial issues were taken care of. Said, well, you know, what about housing? They said, well, go down here and talk to them, see what they can work out for you. Went down there, talked to Cindy in housing, and she said, well, we have one family unit left. It's yours if you want it. I said, yeah, but I said, we don't have money for a deposit. She said, well, the $200 you paid Southern just transfers over for your deposit. So then we went down to see about what kind of classes I'd be eligible for. You know, I'd sent my transcript, so I wanted to see what was available. And so I got down there, and they said, well, you can take this class and this class, but we don't have your transcript, so we really can't tell you. I said, well, I'll send them in, you know, a couple, 3 weeks ago. They said, well, go down to admissions registrar and see what's going on. So we walked down there, and they looked and came back and said, oh, yeah, we found your transcripts. They're at the bottom of the stack right here. But since you're already here, we'll put you at the top and evaluate your transcripts. In less than an hour, I had 80 transfer credits there waiting for me. We still had Matthew to consider. With his piano, he had a world-renowned piano teacher in Asheville. The man was, the runner-up in the Van Cliburn competition. He was just very well-known, very good with Matthew. And, you know, that was one thing we said, Matthew has to be taken care of. We're not going to just do this and leave him to flounder. So we went to down there, and during these lessons, the people putting on the program were the Ashtons, and Bruce Ashton was the head of the music department at Southern for 30-plus years, still teaches there some classes. And so we were talking to him, hoping maybe he would take Matthew as a student. But he told me he's retired and he just does one class. But he says, you know, my replacement, Dr. Peter Cooper, you know, he may take Matthew, but he's going out of town right now, so I'll give you his contact information. So Dr. Ashton went looking. He said, you know, he said, Peter may still be here. Let's walk up to his office and see if he's here. So we walked up there, and all of a sudden, blink, 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 piano playing, and Dr. Cooper was in his office. And so we went there and spent 45 minutes talking to him, and he was very receptive towards taking Matthew as a student. He said, come back in 2 weeks. Bring Matthew. He said, I'd like for him to play for me and talk to him, and we'll discuss that and the finances and all that sort of thing. And so we walked out, and I remember talking to Shan, thinking, you know, are we coming here this year? And she said, well, it's kind of looking that way. And so we walked down, we went over, we were hungry, went over to the village market, we'll get a little thing of some kind of fake sandwich spread and some bread. And while we were there, she went and looked at the bulletin board and saw that it is written was hiring for employees. They were moving from California to Chattanooga. And so Shan was working as a secretary at that time at one of the local churches. And she said, well, maybe I'd get a secretary job. So she got the information and we took it back home. She went online, filled out the information, never heard anything back. So forget that. 2 weeks later, we went back down to Southern and talked to Dr. Cooper. Matthew played for him, and long story short, he said he'd love to take Matthew as a student. Well, Peter was, for his fee, he usually charged about $100 an hour, which I didn't have $100 an hour. I said, well, Lord, you know, what are you going to do? Peter said, you know, don't let money be a hindrance. And I thought, well, you know, maybe he'll cut it in half. And so I asked him, I said, okay, well, what's the bottom line? He said, well, is $5 too much? I said, $5 a half an hour? He said, no, $5 a lesson. He said, I don't even normally charge that. He said, I don't charge that. He said, but, you know, if people pay, they feel better. They're doing something, you know. He said, but the money's not the issue. He said, the college is where I get my money. I do this because I love helping people. And so that office was taken care of. The dean of music at Southern Adventist University became Matthew's piano teacher. And so we went back home, put in our resignations for our jobs. End of July that year, we were moving down to College Dell, the hottest, sweatiest day since the fire hit Sodom and Gomorrah. It was hot, but we were moving in. We moved in. In August, I started classes. In October of that year, I got a call. We were shopping at Walmart for our Sabbath food that we need to get done before Sabbath came. There was a call on my phone from a 704 area code, and I knew that was from the Charlotte, North Carolina area. I said, well, I'm not expecting anybody from there. And she never does this, and I don't know why she did it, but she said, give me the phone, I'll answer it. She answered it, and it was John Bradshaw on the phone. He said, we got your application, and we're impressed what you wrote, and we'd like to interview you. He said, can you do a Skype interview with us? And she said, well, I'm already here in Chattanooga. He said, well, great, that's even better. He said, I'm not here, but my treasurer's here. Go on this day, go down there, and we'll interview you that way. So she went down there, interviewed, was shown around by a very nice lady, and she came back and she said, worst interview I ever had. She said it was awful. But, you know, if you know Shan, she's always not putting herself first. And so, you know, we didn't think much about it, and then a week or two later, got a call back, and they said, Shan said, we had a lot of people interview for that position, you know, very qualified people. And we prayed about it, and we feel that you're the most qualified for that position. And so here the broke people are coming from Asheville, North Carolina. All the finances taken care of. Now she has a good job that's kind of filling in while Tony goes back to school. For this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. And we began to be merry. And now here we are in the Chatsworth Ranger District. What a blessing. We're so happy to be here. We know this is where God, I mean, just how, if I could tell you how I got from Ranger to here, it's just a miracle, just the way things came about. But it was a blessing how we got here. But yet, I don't think we fully grasped the love that God has for us till we understood the love we have for the people that we serve and the people that we reach out to. When I got sick, that even helped me more to understand the love God has for us. You know, as we reach out to others, we think, wow, that you can't explain it. And so we understood what God had for us, why he brought us here. And when Jesus' love is in us, it'll flow through us. And we can't help but love other people. So you see, from a simple evangelistic card sent out 90 years ago, generations of a family. Generations of families. God only knows the people that have been touched because of that one card that was sent out. The love of one person to take one little card, to write a name and address on it, to put a stamp on it, put it in the mailbox. It was the difference of life and death of countless numbers of people. One simple card. And you know what? We have that same opportunity. We've been mailing out cards. We had meetings with John and Karen Jellin last week about these cards that come in, people that are asking for Bible studies. Simple cards that the church had mailed out. And the people filled them out and mailed them back in. We didn't have to even go out looking for them. They said, here we are. We want to know about Jesus. All we have to do is follow up on those cards. Go to those people and say, here's your Bible study. Would you like us to study with you? Can I pray with you? John and Karen are going to be here back here on the 10th of August. Be here for those meetings. You'll be blessed. They are godly people that will teach you things that even you say, I can't do this. We can all do something. If that person hadn't mailed that card back, I shudder thinking where I'd be today. If I'd be here, if I'd even be alive today, if that person hadn't sent that card in. Do you love your neighbors? Your friends and your family? Give out something. Take a glow track, give to somebody. A step to Christ to your friend, a co-worker. Invite them to church. Invite them to our meetings that are going to be coming up before too long. If you don't know, we're going to have evangelistic meetings not too far down the road. Share a book like Keith did with me. It may be the difference. Do something. When I first came to Southern, I was driving down here the first week. I was listening to a sermon by Eugene Pruitt. Remember he said, sometimes God brings us into ministry to save others. Sometimes he brings us into ministry to save us. I know that's why he brought me into ministry. No question about it. Save a life. In doing so, the life you save may be the life that saves you. And I myself thought it was good to declare the signs and the wonders that the Most High God has worked for me. He has done wonders in my life that this sermon only began to scratch the surface of. And he will do that for you. What are you going to do? What are you going to do when God says, I need you? Being in these benches aren't what he has for us, folks. In Matthew 28, verse 19 and 20, go into all the world. Make disciples. Make disciples. Teach people. But you got to go. He didn't say go to church. He says go into the world. Go and make disciples. Teach them. Teach them about Jesus. Teach them what to believe. Then baptize. And then tell them, okay, now that you've been baptized, go back and do what you've been taught to do, and you bring more people. When we do that, what's going to happen? The end will come. Do you want the end to come? Then let's get up and let's go out and share our testimony with others so Christ can come and take us home soon. Let us pray. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for the things you allow into our lives. We don't always understand them. We don't always like them. We run from them. But Lord, we know that you are working our life to try us as gold in the fire. Fire burns, but it refines, it purifies, and it makes your people ready for your kingdom. And Lord, as we go through these things, we pray that you will fit us for your work. Give us the wisdom, give us the knowledge, but most of all, give us the desire, because we know that But that is what you want from us, a willing heart. So, Lord, I pray that you will send your Spirit to impress upon all of us to go into the world.